Session number 3970, wheel number 4.
Mr. Goldsmith, reel 4.
I don't think that the security list was a feeble excuse at all. As I said before, on hindsight, I don't blame the government reacting the way it did on the 10th of May. I don't blame it. From what the government knew at that stage. You see, it is far easier and far more secure than simply say intern the lot and be done with it, than start at that particular point to sift them all through again. I can see nothing wrong with that decision.
And what about the system by which the decision was carried out?
Oh, the system by which this was carried out, as far as my own personal experience are concerned, I have no grumbles either. I mean, we certainly weren't pushed or kicked or anything like that. I mean, we were collected by a policeman, as I said before. We take to an army camp and were treated fairly. I've got no grumbles. The only time we were wrongly treated was on the Dunia. That was the only time in the whole period. No problem there.
Do you think the fact that you look back on it without horror has to do with the fact that you were so young at the time? Of course you were separate from your parents, but you weren't married, you didn't have your own family, you didn't have a career.
That is all very true, and perhaps it was less worrying from a personal social point of view for me than for most of the others whom it affected. But that doesn't affect my judgment of the government's action. Right? One has nothing to do with the other. That I had a lighter time of it from a conscious point of view and a social point of view, I'm not denying. But that is a question of age and commitments rather than anything else.
What proportion of people in the camp were in your age group?
Oh, I wouldn't like to say. I would have thought that the spread of ages between 16 and 65 was about average proportion to the proportion of people in those age groups. I don't think there was a predominance of old or young, although I would have thought that perhaps on the whole they were more inclined to be older rather than younger. And this applies to the army, to the pioneer companies as well.
Why would that be?
I don't know. I have no idea. It could have to do with the simple fact that perhaps a higher proportion of older people came to England. And younger people might have found it easier to emigrate to other countries. This may be the reason. You see, as far as the refugees to this country were concerned, there was this group of so-called children up to the age of 17 and a half were allowed in a certain quota, and I was one of those. Or was it up to 16 and a half? No, I was 16 and a half. It was up to 70, something like that. And, of course, a number of those were in those camps. But I think then the following age group up to about 35 was thinner than the age group in 35 and 65. I think this had something to do with younger people emigrating to other countries more easily, like to Israel, and also be more inclined to emigrate to overseas countries, and the older people more inclined to trying to get to this country. I think this is the reason. And of course, this reflected itself both in the age groups in internment and in the army.
What language did you speak in the camps?
Ah, now you're asking me. I would have thought a mixture of English and German and a variation of both that nobody else could understand. I think that's fair comment. Although I would have thought in the army, in internment I would have thought German may have predominated, but I think in the army English predominated. Although you must realize that a lot of them spoke very little English or very bad English. You can imagine if somebody came to this country, and after all, some of them had only been here a number of months rather than years, and their ability to learn English was reduced by their age. You see, so.
How was your English by the time you were interned?
Oh, I would have thought reasonable. Reasonable. I was able. My accent was never perfect, and never even isn't today, but I think I was able to communicate freely. I think my command of the language was, to put it, adequate, without being brilliant. Is that fair?
What language did you use to communicate?
Oh, only English. Only English. For the simple reason
that... You took about 3 months, didn't you?
Yes, yeah. I mean, that you could say you could freely communicate.
Because when you first came, you didn't hear any German.
Yeah. You see, I had a great advantage here that my future mother-in-law spoke perfect German, although she was born in Glasgow. And through that, I had no difficulty in asking him. You see, if I would have moved into a family that could speak no German at all, in one respect, it might have forced one to speak English even quicker. But on the other hand, one wouldn't have had the ability to communicate and get all the answers to various questions. Now, the English language has never given me any problems. Spelling does. Still does on occasions, but that's another matter.
You said that in hay camp you did some work outside the barbed wire with an allotment.
Yeah.
What did you do at Tatura?
I can't remember whether it was in Tatura or in hay or even in Bamira. In one of the camps we were employed on building a prisoner of war camp for Italian prisoners of war. Because you will recall that a great number of Italian prisoners of war were taken in North Africa. And for that purpose, we were employed on that. But I can't remember in which one of the camps it was. It might well have been at Hay.
When I saw you before, you suggested that was why you'd had to leave Hay, that because of the Italian influx, you were making room at Hay and going on to
Tatura. That is quite possible. That's quite possible. Why the actual movement took place. But certainly this is right with the timing, because this is all to do with the push from an Alamein and Tobruk and all these things, and there were a tremendous number of Italian prisoners of war taken, and a lot of them were shipped out to Australia because of these least security risks or small security risks out there.
Did you have to do that work, or did you want to do it for something to do?
Don't think anybody would have been compelled to do it, but I think there might have been incentives. I can't remember, but quite frankly, when you have been months and months and months behind barbed wire, quite frankly, any occupation, unless it's really either degrading or something else, doesn't do one any harm.
What kind of social occupations did you have? I mean, sports.
Social occupations. Well, let's be quite clear. There were, first of all, no ladies present. Social occupations. I think we were given a certain amount of sports equipment. I think there were footballs and that sort of thing. And there were even organized football matches and that sort of thing. But social activities otherwise... As I said, there were a lot of group activities, and there were choirs, and I'm sure we had theatre performances and that sort of thing. And we had, in fact, conductor, and who I think played for the BBC afterwards. What was his name? then we'll come back to him in a, anyway, he composed a beautiful song which started with the words, I remember, don't ask me to sing them, please. Say hey for happy, and you feel snappy, and you won't want to die. Why should we still remember it? What was his name? Martin. Ray Martin. Do you remember that name at all? As a banker, yes, Ray Martin was his name. I can certainly remember him, hearing of him after the war. And he wrote these songs. Oh, there was all sorts of activities, but nothing that I can particularly recall.
How widespread was homosexuality?
Oh. I don't know. I have no idea.
You were in a situation rather similar to sailors on a ship for...
Yes.
...for months on end, since you couldn't leave. So I sort of expected that a fair amount.
I wouldn't be at all surprised. On the other hand, I wouldn't also be at all surprised that the authorities took to the usual practice of putting such things as bromide into tea, right? So, I mean, one balances the other.
I've heard they did. In fact, I understand that every day, this was on the Isle of Man, people speculated, is it in the porridge? Is it in the tea? Is it in the stew? And then they would all refuse to eat the porridge if the rumour got round.
Well, I certainly would have never thought that they put it anywhere other than the tea, but that's another matter, because I don't think it is suitable for inclusion anywhere else. But again, I'm no chemist, so I wouldn't like to know.
I have no idea if it's true that it was used at all, but if people think that it is, then perhaps that's enough.
Quite possible. I mean, the effect is most likely the same whether it is there or whether people think it is there. It's like there is a word for it somewhere, for suggestive therapy or whatever they call it or something. Or is it the same as doctors prescribing pills which are negative and people think that they will help the headaches and it helps the headaches, right?
What did you do in camp about Jewish and Christian festivals?
As I said previously, I can't remember a great deal of religious activity in the camps. And also,
you don't have to be religious to enjoy having a religious festival.
No, I don't think, as I say, there was very little. And also, I don't think there was... First of all, there weren't... When you say Christian festivals, the first thing is that there were very few Christians in the camp as such, so that wouldn't apply at all. If you mean public holidays, well, in an internment camp, Christmas is like the day before, and Easter is like the day afterwards. It doesn't make the slightest difference. There might have been special army rations for those occasions, quite possibly, but I would have thought that was the lot. And then don't forget that Christmas, in particular in Australia, is rather hot, rather unseasonable. So it just doesn't make sense.
Did you have any times, Christmas could have been one of them, when you would all come together and have a little talk with platitudes from camp officers?
No. You see, the camp... When you mean camp officers, do you mean the... leaders of the camp, or do you mean the officers in charge of the camp?
The Australian administrators.
No. You see, the Australian administrators, as far as they were concerned, they couldn't have had an easier life. They never had any trouble, because they weren't the sort of people that would give them trouble in the normal sense of internees. The only problems they might have had, that they were badgered for better communications with submissions to government and that sort of thing. But I think these would have been verbal by the camp leaders rather than any great representations or demonstrations or anything of that nature. And as I said, I don't think there were ever any escape attempts. attempts or anything of that nature. So, I mean, they just had no problems, you see. I mean, the camps ran themselves. All they did was, we've got 999 in, they are entitled to so many rations, add it together, take it in, forget about it. You see, there was a minimum amount of guards on the outside and that sort of thing. No, it's just, I mean, it is roughly the same situation as you may have seen reports in the paper last Sunday of a Jewish ex-servicemen's parade in Whitehall. Now, the police stated there that that is the best demonstration and the best organization they have throughout the year, excluding, of course, the military parade on Armistice Sunday. You see, it's the identical situation, you see, although they're there for the opposite reason, right, to stop any outsiders from interfering. But they certainly never expect any trouble from them. It's the same type of people, and it's the same type of situation, you see. That's the best way of illustrating it.
You said that the guards, when you arrived in Australia, were First World War veterans.
Yes.
Were the administrators of the camp the same?
Oh, I would have thought so. I wouldn't have thought that they would have kept any... I can't remember, but I would have thought that they've taken veterans from the First World War for that sort of situation. Oh, yes. Because what's the point of using up valuable young officers for administering internment camps back at home? I mean, that... wouldn't be quite sensible.
This is a lovely picture of sweetness and light all round.
But very boring. It's as simple as that. You see, all we were interested in, when we're going to get out. No, you see, there was never any worry, there was never any danger, there were never any shortages. The only worries was what was going on in England, what was going, when do I get my next letter, and that sort of thing, but never any physical problems. I mean, when I say no physical problems, I mean, of course, if somebody was ill, somebody was ill, but I mean, it didn't affect the inmates as a whole, you see.
You left us in Liverpool near Sydney.
That's right.
On your way back to England.
Yes. That was the that was sort of a transit camp. It was in a suburb of Sydney.
When you joined the British Army, or agreed to join,
yes,
was it understood that you could become a British citizen?
No, I don't think that was mentioned at all at that time. That question only arose later. You see, the law was that during hostilities, no naturalization took place at all, whatsoever, to the best of my knowledge. You just couldn't apply. They wouldn't have entertained it. So there was not any question of it, although one hoped and one presumed. But there was never any assurance of that effect, to my knowledge, or at least as far as I can remember.
How voluntary was your volunteering for the British Army?
Oh, very voluntary. Because, I mean, you must put yourself into the atmosphere, right? Quite apart from being in an internment camp. Other people were being conscripted, and there was the Hitler situation, right? Oh yes, as far as that was concerned, it was most certainly voluntary. There was no pressure. If you can think of any pressure, it was simply, if there was any pressure at all, it was the psychological pressure of that, perhaps at that particular moment, being the quickest way of getting out of the camp. Yes, in that sense. But otherwise, it was certainly no pressure, direct pressure being brought to bear or said, well, if you don't volunteer, you jolly well stick here until the end of the war, something like that. No, that certainly didn't happen.
What proportion of you would you say did volunteer?
Oh, I would say a very high proportion of those who were the right age. And I would have thought that there was a pretty even proportion who volunteered to serve in the Australian Army and those who volunteered to serve in the British Army. A pretty high proportion, and I think most of the others were released, quite a number in Australia, and I think the others came home pretty soon thereafter, not long thereafter, although I lost track of that particular problem. Left me Liverpool, right. So we were 3 weeks in Liverpool, and this was definitely after the outbreak of the Japanese War, so I can't say we exactly looked forward to going back at that particular point with the situation as it was in the Pacific. And I remember a gentleman called Brandt, of happy memories, I don't think, coming either to the ship. He was from the Jewish community in Sydney, and he was the liaison officer, coming and telling us, you will have escort all the way. Anyway, we joined the ship, which was the Lark's Bay, ship of some 14,000 tons, which was passenger and goods, and was one of the six ships belonging to the Aberdeen and Cromwell's line, the other being the Jervis Bay, which was a cruiser, was fitted as a cruiser and sunk in the southern Atlantic. And I remember the ship being very heavily laden, and we had on board ship, amongst others, a contingent of Australian sailors who were going back to England to pick up a cruiser because HMAS Sydney had been sunk, and in fact the Larkspur is reputed to have been the last ship out of Singapore, out of Batavia, and having passed over near the spot where HMAS Sydney was sunk. Anyway, we set off, and we went first to New Zealand, and the only escort we ever had was we heard, and I think we actually saw, a Catalina flying boat. And coming the following morning round, 2 days later, down the north coast of New Zealand, where the little islands make up the end, the New Zealand cruiser Ajax must have lain in the shadow and pulled up his signal and asking for identification from our ship, which they couldn't have seen. And the Ajax swung its 4-inch guns around, and the flags never went up so quickly. And as a general matter of interest, once we joined the ship, we were free, as everybody else was on board ship. We were under no restriction whatsoever, except that when the ship went into port, we were not allowed ashore, as the sailor and airmen were that we picked up in New Zealand.
Did you have any contact with the sailors?
Oh yes, we totally mixed. Oh yes, there was no, as I say, we were just passengers on board on a ship. It's exactly the same as the Australian sailors and the New Zealand airmen. There was no restriction, and whether we sat at the same tables or actually mixed, or everybody sat just where they fancy. But certainly there were no restriction whatsoever, except the one that we were not allowed to go ashore. We then went into Auckland, and from Auckland we went to Panama, and the journey across the Pacific, and particularly in view of the war situation at that time, was very peaceful and very uneventful. And I can remember the Pacific being as smooth as a duck pond, and apart from flying fish and dolphin and albatrosses, we saw literally nothing for the first 19 days, I think, of a three-week voyage, when we were picked up by an American destroyer and escorted into the Pacific end of the Panama Canal, and the journey through the Panama Canal sting. And it is exactly as one sees on the pictures. And apart from the technical achievement of these huge locks, the cut is very interesting. I remember the banana trees on the cut being so near that one can always touch them. And the other thing is that large areas of the upper part of the canal are huge lakes, artificial lakes, and dead trees are still standing about after all these years, and looks rather weird. So then after we reached the other end of the Panama Canal, we went to Curaçao to bunker some oil, and we went into the little harbour, which I think is called Wilhelmine's town or stadt or something, and it's a typical Dutch village. Anyway, we had to come straight out again and go further up the island to the refinery itself, where we bunkered. And from there, we went to Bermuda. And as we approached Bermuda, a battleship was coming out. And I remember having an argument with the Australian sailors as to what it was, and recognizing that it was a four-gun turret ship. This had to be the King George V, as the sister ship, the Prince of Wales, had been sunk and the Malayan campaign, and these were the only two battleships at that time with four-gun turrets. And I was proved right afterwards, as it became known that George V had been sent to Bermuda to bring Churchill back to England after his meeting with Roosevelt, but apparently he was flown out owing to some security risks, as they thought the Germans had got wind of it. Anyway, we left Bermuda after a day or so in convoy, more or less in line ahead of four ships, and we were the second, and as far as I know, the last two never got to Halifax. And we left Bermuda in what was more or less subtropical heat, and we arrived in Halifax in the midst of winter, at near the end of January. And Halifax was interesting from the point of view. We lay there 10 days and we were anchored right opposite the town with the naval station behind us, and Halifax was the point at which the North Atlantic convoys were assembled, as it has got an apparently huge pool or harbour, natural harbour, behind the town where there's room to anchor 1,000 ships. So we lay there for 10 days and watched all these ships go in and out. And it was bitter cold. I can remember snow blowing down the ventilators and actually lying in the bottom of the cabins. So eventually we left in a convoy with two destroyers and one Dutch passenger ship. And we had a U-boat alarm the first night out. We thought, well, if that's the first night out, what's the rest of the journey going to be like? But luckily that was the end. We changed destroyer escorts to mid-Atlantic. The Canadians left us and two English destroyers took over. And we found out afterwards that we went round the south coast of Ireland. If the Admiralty would like to, even at this late stage, explain to me why they took a convoy round the south coast of Ireland to go to Glasgow, when the Gnadenhorst and Schneisenau were lying in Brest, I would be pleased to hear that explanation. Anyway, we arrived safely in Glasgow and were collected by a detachment of the Black Watch in full wartime regalia with fixed bayonets. We're taken through dingy Glasgow to an army barracks in the blackout and were fed, and I believe we were put on the train that night. And I recall standing on blacked out Wigan station in the middle of the night in the blackout in wartime. We arrived in Liverpool, and having started off from Huyton, of all the places in this world, I came back to Huyton. In fact, we were greeted at the station by Major Leighton, who was the liaison officer between Woburn House, the Jewish Refugee Committee, and the War Office. And I can remember him inquiring whether someone was in our group, beginning with the letter A, and The answer was no, and for some reason G must have been the first letter in our group. So he asked whether I was there, and I said yes. And apparently there had been several groups expected at the same time. So his first thing he did was to instruct the sergeant in charge of the guard to ask his men to unfix their bayonets and put them away.
So had you come in contact with Major Layton before?
No.
I think he'd been out in Australia.
He had been out in Australia. Then I had been in contact with him. In fact, he came out to do the actual recruiting, if you can call it that way. Yes, that is very likely. Yes, I forgot about that. Yes. Anyway, we were then taken to an army hut and were sworn in. And I always recall being marched in at one end under armed guards and coming out at the other end with a king's shilling in my hand. And I have actually in front of me the actual certificate of attestation signed by the recruiting officer of number 86 Center on the 10th day of February 1942. And I started my army service in the same street in which I had been interned, but on the other side of the wire fence, which, as far as I remember then, contained Italian prisoners of war.
When did you change your name?
End of accession number 3970, reel 4.